Thanks so much for joining us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to a new book that's out that I've liked a lot, and it has to do with the Cates Family Farm. It's nestled in a valley in Iowa County, included in the Wisconsin Driftless region of our state. It's rich in history, Lowry Creek watershed, and the farm established there is the subject of this book. And it's titled A Creek Runs Through This Driftless Land, a farm family's journey toward a land ethic. And it was written by Richard Cates Jr., longtime farmer, co-owner of the Cates Family Farm. He's the author of the book that we'll be talking about. And I hope you'll join in as we visit with Richard. Are you a farmer? Maybe you grew up on a farm. Do you wonder how farmers view the land and their responsibility to conserve it? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Richard Cates, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, Larry, thank you so much. You are an honest icon, Wisconsin icon, and I just, it's such a joy to be with you again. You had me on years ago and for a number of different topics, and I'm always, it's always a joy and a pleasure.
Well,
thank you, sir.
Well, thank you for writing your book. I really enjoyed reading it, and it's kind of a nice history of your family as it farmed for, I think, five generations, isn't it? No?
Yeah, I guess you could call our grandchildren our rising fourth. So, you know, in Wisconsin, we go back five, and, you know, but when I think about the history of our land, it goes, it's been peopled by those who've cared for it for more than 10,000 years. So we're kind of newcomers, I guess.
Yeah, and you do get into who came before in the early stages of your book, and I enjoyed reading that as well.
Yeah, thank you.
Maybe describe the location of the farm.
Sure. Larry, if I could, I can give a couple sentences of overview, but I just read a brief piece from my book that talks, that puts us right into the Lowry Creek watershed.
That would be perfect. Go ahead.
Okay, so we're in the Driftless area, and that is, for folks who aren't as familiar, the area where there was no glacial activity, in other words, no drift, which is the soil and the stones that the glacier pushes. So it's the hilly and almost mountainous part of southwest Wisconsin. It's quite magical to all of us who live there. And so I'm going to read you a couple paragraphs. I'm going to put you right there where we live. The cold, clear, spring-fed waters of Lowry Creek emerge to greet the light of day from cracks in the limestone and sandstone bedrock laid down by an ancient ocean half a billion years ago, when the North American tectonic plate was part of an enormous landmass known as Laurentia. And at that time, the Driftless area was located in the vast ocean near the Earth's equator, just beginning its long, slow slide to the north. And Larry, that goes into how I'm walking along this water course with my dear granddaughter, Sloan Helen Cates, and how we look down and she sees something moving. I tell her it's probably trout dessert and she laughs. But what I see are the reflections of all who've walked this valley for the past 10,000 years. We have very strong archaeological evidence in the headwaters of our creek. We now have a site by my neighbor, Joe Stapleton, had it authorized by the Smithsonian Institute. We've got artifacts or cultural pieces back 10,000 years. And so for that long, people have been using this water course between the Wisconsin River and the head and the high ground. And trout has been gone. The native trout has been gone since unintended European farming consequences. From part of a century ago. But now Sloan and I are looking down, and the iconic brook trout is back. And it's really a miracle. It's a gift. It's a joy. It's a result of all the people in my community who have tried to do better on the land. And we've cleaned the water up, and the book that trout have come back. So I'll conclude, this water is the lifeblood of the valley. It is indeed, along with the flesh and blood of my granddaughter, one of Earth's innumerable gifts.
It's very well put. Well, and, you know, you talk about the farm. You say our farm runs on sunshine and rain,
yes,
healthy soil, and good relationships.
Yes. Well, it took a long, long time. I was a young man raised in the 80s with, we were told, you know, there's only one way to farm. You get big, and you get big as quick as you can. And, you know, we have all these modern miracles to help you with the different herbicides and pesticides. And I went that direction. I had an 800-head beef operation. The problem is in Wisconsin, that takes a lot of farms. And so I ran on three farms, and I wasn't focused on what the opportunity right in front of us as a family was to build community and build community around taking care of that beautiful landscape. And once my dear wife, my best friend, told me that, she made me realize there's another way, a really good way. And she saved the farm, and I often say she saved me from myself. So it was quite a journey.
Ben, you know, it was interesting to me, and I wondered if this had an impact and caused you to go that earlier way that you went, because you spent time after you received your PhD in soil science, you wound up in Saudi Arabia.
That was a most interesting segment
of your book. 3 years on a farm in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, well, thank you for bringing that up, because I had a most remarkable experience at the Department of Soil Science, University of Wisconsin-Madison, under Dr. Zenas Kinney and Robin Harris. Unfortunately, Robin just passed.
Yeah.
Very sad thing. And other leaders in the Department of Soil Science. But I wanted to work overseas, and I turned out a person I knew quite well from an earliest stage in my training, my soils training, was actually working in the Middle East. They called us up because they knew we wanted to come overseas and said, "Hey, Dick, I'm working on the largest dairy farm in the world. My job is to run a soils and plant lab and raise all the crops to feed 6,000 cows. Would you like to come and take my job? Because I'm going to be leaving." So him and I, we said, "What?" And, oh, within a week, we said, "Sure, why not?" And so I spent 3 years. The farm eventually was the largest vertically integrated dairy farm in the world, and my job was to feed 10,000 cows, 28,000 animals daily on feed we grew under irrigation in the Arabian Desert. And really, long story short, the way I was able to be successful is because of my soils degree. I saw all the manure that was being wasted, piled up in the desert, and I did trials, and I showed them, look, you're going to reduce your fertilizer costs. You're going to improve the soil if you put this stuff on. And sure enough, in time, they did, and it was a success. But we were glad to be there only 3 years when we came back to our home farm, which was too rough and too hilly and too wet when I was a boy. All of a sudden, it looked like Shangri-La, and we never left. That was in 1987.
Oh, a great story, and I thought it was kind of interesting to me. You know, your dad, Dick Cate Sr., he was a very nationally respected attorney.
Yeah.
He'd spent time, I think, when he was in law school, working on a farm to raise money to get himself through law school.
Right. Yeah.
And he bought this farm, and I wondered, I think you even speculate, you wonder if he was buying it for himself or really to give you all, you know, the family, the chance to live under those kinds of farm conditions living in the country.
Yes. Yes. Well, he was from back in New England. He worked on his uncle's farms in Maine as soon as he was a teenager, and then in college, and then after he got out of the Marines. And he just had farming in his blood, but he wanted to come to Wisconsin because he thought this was the land of milk and honey. This is where the soil is good. The land is, there's not so many rocks. And he came out here, went to law school, but in the first year, he worked for a family named Bribey out in Dane, Wisconsin, and that way he could transport himself into Madison. But he worked for room and board, not wages. But he worked so hard, and he was such a voracious eater that he has great stories. And Mr. and Mrs. Bribey would sit there at the table and watch him go into his thirds. And then Hans finally said, "Hates, I should have hired you for wages." He was eating him out of house and home. But he got this farm. This farm was no longer a working farm because he wanted his kids to have some of the background he had, and he wanted us to learn to work. And by God, it did work. We did what he said, and he didn't know what we were doing, but we did what he said, and I'm the one who stuck with it. And it was a great, great, great experience.
Well, as you said, you kind of wanted to go big. One of the things I like about the book is that, I mean, it's well written, but you also get into the mistakes you made. And I think that's really important for people to be able to read something like that. It's not all sugar-coated here.
No, and I thank you for noting that. And, isn't that the way life is? If we went around and said, gee, we made the right choice on the first go-round, we probably hadn't been doing many things because failure is a lot of success. And I always say that imagination, besides passion, imagination is really what'll propel us all forward. If it doesn't work the first time, figure out a different way to do it. And that was Einstein's thing, is imagination is even more important than knowledge, because you have to figure out, if you've got a bunch of facts, you have to imagine how to put them together. And we did. We had there's a lot of fun stories in this book of trial and error, for sure. Larry, thank you for bringing that up.
Well, yeah. And I noted back when, at one point, your dad bought a chisel plow.
Yeah.
And you didn't like it at first.
No, it was 1976, and hardly anybody did conservation tillage at that time. I was used to soil looking flat and black, and why did they call, when you looked at a field that had stalks in it, they called that trash. Well, that's a bad word to call organic matter that's sitting on your soil to keep it out of the stream, but that's what they called it. And so as a boy who had never used a chisel plow, I went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. I was trying to bury all that stuff, but that's not what a chisel plow does. Well, thankfully, my neighbor, he was one of Frank Lloyd Wright's proteges, he stopped on over and he says, Dick, it's supposed to look like that. Now you just go park your tractor and rest in the shade and have a good day. That was 1976.
But through that, you became a real proponent of that kind of work.
Yeah. Yeah, we really did take it to heart. And when I came home from going back now, when I came back from freshman year of college, 1971, my dad gave me as a Christmas present Aldo Leopold's book, A Sand County Almanac. And he said, take a look at it, read it, we'll talk about it. I did before I went back to college. Didn't understand a thing. But we spent a lifetime, my father and I, he helping me. We went to see Wendell Berry and Wes Jackson, two of Leopold's disciples, speak at the Shack in the late 70s, early 80s. And I started to get this stuff. And I said, you know, I often say now Leopold's words have challenged me and nurtured me through my whole life. But the notion of a land ethic, personal care of what we've been given, I call them Earth's gifts, and that's Robin Wall Kimmerer's term, is really what I feel a responsibility to do. And our son who run and daughter-in-law, Eric and Kylie, who run the farm now, they've added as a tagline on their website and on our all of our pair of shirts and hats, a commitment to conservation. So it's in our heart, it's in our blood, and all I want to do is show folks that it's very possible to do that, to keep your soil on the land and not in the water, and your brook trout will come back. And it's a joy. It's a joy to farm and live that way.
Yeah. Richard Cates, Jr., Dick Cates, is the author of A Creek Runs Through This Driftless Land, A Farm Family's Journey Toward a Land Ethic. And we'll continue to talk with him. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Talking today with Richard Cates about his book, A Creek Runs Through This Driftless Land. And you can join in if you have a question or comment, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. I want to go, you tried to go big, and then you turned around and discovered that you could actually have a very good living in other ways. Rotational grazing is something that you got into. Talk about that whole switch.
Oh, you bet, Larry. Yeah, it's multi-pronged. It's not just one thing. But once we realized when we came back to Wisconsin, we watched some other really good farmers implement motion or rotation on their grasslands. And we realized that that's what the bison have done so successfully for thousands of years. It's really that motion. Is nothing's taken down, the grass isn't taken too short. They're not allowed to stand in one wet spot too long. We move them every day. We have portable fence. It's very simple to erect now. So that was part of it. And we continue to get bigger thinking, okay, we got more cattle. We've got a low-cost way to do this thing. But that wasn't enough. What Kim really taught me was what we haven't done is the other pieces in the three-legged stool of sustainability. We haven't built community around what it is we were doing. And she said, you sold a few steers to friends and neighbors, and they made you some money. Why don't you do more of it? I said, that's not what a farmer does. You grow stuff. And she said, well, look again at the bottom line. And, of course, a few years later, not looking back, I took some credit for the idea. But the notion is that for the first time in my life, rather than taking our livestock to the market and getting the highest bidder, but a very informal exchange, and it was always too low to cover all the expenses and an income, to boot, people would come to the farm and thank us. I mean, there's no going back from that. Thank us for caring for the land, caring for the stream, and for providing good food. And we charge them a very reasonable rate. And it was just a joy. It became the connection, the circle that was closed. I do owe that to my dear wife. But it's the rotational grazing, taking care of the grassland, and it's the relationships with the community that's out there that has to eat every day of their lives. So it's a cool, cool thing.
You have a bur oak tree that stands in the center of your farm. And I kind of like the fact that you mentioned that bur oak tree and kind of talk about it. What's the significance of that tree to you?
Yes. Oh, so many things. So back when they did the original land surveys in the 1820s, that was one of the marker trees. The other two are gone. So it's still there and was used when Europeans were first, Americans were first laying out these plots of land. But more significantly, it is a descendant of 8,000 years of a fire-dependent landscape. That landscape, ever since the retreat of the cold Pleistocene, has been a grassland or an oak savanna, more specifically, of grass and trees, that was kept open by fire, first natural fire from lightning, and then the indigenous people kept travel ways and hunting ways open through fire. And those corky bark trees in the white oak family, and that's a bur oak, they were was able to withstand the fire. So we had it aged, we had it cored by a DNR employee who happened to be the great-grandson of Aldo Leopold. His name is Jed Mounier, and he lives in Madison. And we found it to be about 240 years old. All the other oak trees of that age are gone in our area because they were in the way of farming, and that was close enough to the stream that they left it. And so not only has it informed us of that long, long history of grassland and people moving up and down that valley from the Wisconsin River to the uplands where they spent winters hunting, but it also is the beauty, the shade, the elegance. And we look at it every day, and we see it out our window. People get married under it. It's just a gift.
Yeah, it is. And before the valley was formed, as you say, it was a grassy kind of oak savanna. And you've actually tried to bring back at least a portion of that oak savanna on your own farm.
We did. Not only where we graze, where we've stayed with the grasses that want to come based on our rotational grazing, and those happen to be mostly cool season grasses. We all know the names, brome grass, quack grass, fescue, bluegrass. But there's another spot up on the ridge that was never grazed so hard, and we had an ecologist and our forester travel that, walk that with us in early 2000. They said, oh my, the forbs that were here on the landscape are still here. They're just recessed. And if you open this landscape up, bring some light in, so remove some of the top growth, remove some of the stems, and bring back fire, you'll get these, not just these grasses that were from our prairie ecosystem, but these forbs. And we spent 20 years doing that. We've burned it 9 times. We've removed shrub with fire and axe, and it's just been a joy taking people up there where our son and his beautiful wife, Kylie, got married in 2015. It's as much a part of the farm as the working landscapes down below. And in fact, our little young son, my parents, Kim's parents, are all, their ashes are all remaining on that hill in the restored oak savanna. It's a very beautiful and moving place.
It is indeed. And there's an email from Mark to ask, what is your wish for the future? What do you wish for your great-grandkids?
Yes, I have several wishes. But one is that as a culture, we embrace the notion of a land ethic. And really that means care for the soil, water, plants, and animals that are in place that we are responsible for. It's no different than having an ethic of care for each other. We wouldn't walk into a public space and cut off someone's arm. When you're farming and you let soil go down into the river or the creek, that's essentially what you're doing. You're taking the lifeblood of that soil, of that landscape, and removing it. You're sending it somewhere else. I would hope that we have matured in the notion of a land ethic. That's one thing. The other thing is that I hope, although our food system we have in place now isn't going to go away, it's very effective at feeding many, 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 many folks across the planet. But as people become more in tune with protecting their ecosystem, I would hope that there's more and more places for young farmers who have these ethics and are supported by people who want the kind of land protection and the food choices that they provide. So those are some of my dreams.
Yeah, I think they're great dreams. And you know, here you are. You've been in that for so long in your family. And most of the farms in that area just weren't able to kind of succeed.
Exactly. You know, when you get on a marginal landscape, and I use the term marginal based on the fact that I'm from an agricultural perspective, farmers leave and they go to better land if they can afford it, or they just stop. And so the land has been purchased by very well-meaning, good folks who have the money to buy land and take care of it in some really nice ways, and growing prairie, and which is very beneficial to birds and bees, and it's just so valuable. But in terms of raising food, many farmers have gone to areas where that's a little easier. But for us, developing that connection with community has made all the difference. It's just been such a rich journey.
I tell you, that it is a rich journey, and your book, I really enjoyed reading your book, Dick. And
Thank you, Larry. Thank you so much.
I'm sorry we're out of time. There is so much more we haven't covered in this book. Richard Cates Jr., Dick Cates Jr., his book, A Creek Runs Through This Driftless Land, a farm family's journey toward a land ethic. I hope you have a chance to take a look at it. It's a wonderful, interesting read. And I want to thank you so much for listening, and thanks to our crew, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, Joe Patnod, Clara Neipert, and our executive producers, of course, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR.